Hi, I'm Phil Palucha from Billionaires in Boxers, and you are about to enjoy an interview hosted by one of our guest hosts, Andrew Tallant. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Confessions of a Successful Leader, hosted by me, Andrew Tallant, the self-coaching expert. In each episode of the show, we hear the insightful confessions of a successful leader who wants to inspire others to live their professional and personal dreams. I am always keen to hear your feedback, particularly in relation to the kinds of leaders you would like me to invite onto the show in future. But for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the rich insights from our special guest. Hello and welcome to another episode of Confessions of a Successful Leader, hosted by me, Andrew Tallant, the self-coaching expert. In each episode of the show, we hear the insightful confessions of a successful leader who wants to inspire others to live their professional and personal dreams. This week, I am delighted that Jan Clark has joined us in the studio. Jan's career as a senior leader in heritage and conservation has taken her across the UK, working at some of the most high-profile Grade 1 listed buildings and historic estates. She has held the post of CEO of various not-for-profit organisations from the Isle of Skye to Cornwall. Her latest focus is as an interim CEO supporting the arts, heritage and conservation charitable trusts. She is a champion of crumbly old buildings and beautiful landscapes, believing that everyone should have access to places of natural beauty and inspiring works of art. Her team span diverse cultural backgrounds, and she has recruited volunteers from children to octogenarians. Jan grew up in a single-parent family in the northwest of England and is the youngest surviving child of seven half-siblings and has lived in 12 different counties across England, Scotland and Wales. She claims to have invented the staycation, choosing to holiday in the UK for most of her adult life in what she describes in her own words as a vague attempt to save the planet, and because she believes that the UK has the most stunning scenery, exceptional remote rural communities, and she loves to forage the hedgerows and capture photographs of the British countryside. Jan is married and is mother to two children. Her leadership style in three words is authentic, collaborative, and informal. Jan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm delighted to join you.
I love that intro. It tells us so much about you personally, but just for the audience's benefit, just tell us a bit more about yourself and where your current focus is.
Of course, yes. I've always loved crumbly old buildings. My career began in hospitality in order to fund my way through university. I worked in catering, as many people my generation did. But I was lucky enough that some of those hotels were in Grade 1 listed buildings. They were beautiful, beautiful buildings, and they had amazing stories. And that, I think, is where that interest was begun, really. And I've always lived in very old buildings in very remote rural locations. So, yeah, I love it.
Yeah, brilliant. And obviously that's a certain lifestyle that you have in those sort of rural locations. So in terms of you as the person and what you do outside of your work interests, what kind of things do you do to spend the time?
I love walking in the countryside with my dogs. I love taking photographs of beautiful sunsets and mainly sort of nature-based landscapes, that sort of thing. And I've always had open fires. I've taken out electric heating systems and put in real fires. And I've always scrumped fruit from the hedgerows and made sort of jams and jellies and chutneys, even when I was a youth. So, yeah, I'm sort of country living and country life in person.
So many people listening and watching this now be so jealous in terms of that, because I know a lot more people out there now are trying to aspire to that kind of life. And it's hard when you've been used to being in a kind of lifestyle and work style, which is just nonstop. You know, and to create that space.
Yeah,
is very
absolutely.
Hard.
It sounds trendy, but it's not. It is a lifestyle that I've always known. So yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure on this podcast and show is all about understanding leaders and what's informed their leadership style. So it'd be lovely again just to get some insight into your experiences earlier in your life, whether that's way back or more recently, that have shaped your leadership style, and it'd be good to understand that.
Yeah, sure. I've always maintained that you always remember your favourite teacher and your best boss. And I have worked from the age of 11, I've been employed. I worked after school in a corner shop, and I worked in pubs, in sort of catering and that sort of thing. And it teaches you independence and the value of money and a great work ethic. And it shapes you as a leader without you even sort of realizing it, because I was almost going to sort of prefix my next thing with unfortunately, but I won't. I've had an awful lot of bad examples in my career of poor leadership, but I think you can learn just as much from people doing it wrong as you can from a really good example, because even if you have a good example, you'll still want to take that and mold it into your way of doing things. Whereas when you've had a really bad boss, you think, I would never do that if I was in charge. So yeah, it's made me a sort of acutely aware of how you are as a boss with other people. And some of the best experiences have come from the most diverse teams. So one thing I've kind of learned is that you never stop learning. So every day you'll come across something you think, God, I didn't know about that. I never thought about it that way. So if you remain curious and mindful of why you're a leader and what you're trying to get from your team, that tends to keep you on the right track. So yeah, I've experienced sexism, racism, inequality, you name it. I've been on the receiving end of poor leadership and poor communication.
I really appreciate you saying that. And again, what many people listening or watching this will relate to is the fact that we get to a certain stage in our careers, sometimes that's sooner, sometimes it's later, where we recognize what served us in the past in terms of us leading successfully, yes, a lot of the time over short periods, stops informing us and stops serving us at some point. We don't really know why. And to your point, we have to become aware of that. Somebody points out to us or we become aware. So can you again just share with us, when did you first notice maybe some things from the past that were driving your leadership style started to maybe impact you negatively, either in relationships or at work, or just some examples would be really lovely to hear.
Sure. Because I was brought up in, from a broken home, was the phrase used, one was not expected to succeed. And I was unusually brought up by my father, not my mother. So that single parent was my dad, not my mum. And again, you kind of recognize when somebody is working very hard in themselves to bust their own myths in terms of, you know, my father was 48 when he became a father, which, you know, over half a century ago was very unusual. And it was very unusual for him to have got custody of his only daughter. He wasn't very good at it, but he had to become a single parent. He went to work full time. I was a latchkey kid from the age of 6. And I went home to an empty house. And it, you know, there will be people sort of shock, horror, that's terrible. Where were social services? Don't know. But you survive. You realize that early on that the only person you've got to rely on really is yourself. And that is something that you kind of carry with you, and you it sustains you through the early years. And then you might find yourself sort of further down in your career. You think, well, actually, I've got a whole team around me. They are sustaining me. I need to reach out to them, because what you can be when you're in a world that is male dominated. I remember one example. It's not that long ago. My first job as chief exec in Cornwall, I did my own press release because there was no one on the team to do that. And the I won't name the newspaper, but a local Cornish newspaper picked up the story, and the headline was "Woman Gets Top Job at Industrial Trust." You know, and I thought, so that's the most remarkable thing about me is that I'm female, and I just thought that what really, and you just think, no, that's not the way to look at this. But I was like the head of a charitable trust that was about industrial and maritime heritage. So the stories and the characters is very male dominated. But you can sort of look beyond that and think, well, hang on a minute. There were the women involved in tin mining in Cornwall was, you know, huge. It was extraordinary. Their contribution should never be overlooked. And yeah, so you have an energy that keeps you going. That's born of, I'm going to make it a success because why shouldn't I? No one else is going to do it for me. And I remember going on a training course with the National Trust, and the National Trust for however they are appearing today, when I started my career with them, they were brilliant with training. And I remember being in this workshop. And they sort of described a leader who was like galloping ahead, you know, sort of we're going to be strong and change all this and blah, blah, blah. And they're like a sort of, you know, a charging elephant, and they're way ahead of the pack. And all the pack can see is like this cloud of dust where you're galloping ahead with all the ideas and all the narrative and all the noise. And you think what I consciously became was a leader who stands in a row with my team. And so I flattened that hierarchy in a good way by saying, I'm one of you. I may be the one that goes in front of the board or the senior management team or whatever it might be, but I am your voice and we are going to deliver this. So that was a conscious leap from recognizing that in my past, I had to be everything and do everything. I was my team. I was my PR. I was my safety net, my safeguarding lead back in the day when those things didn't exist. And so you have to sort of think, no, you're one of a team. You're leading the team, but you're leading from within. And that's why I describe myself as collaborative and informal.
And what I love about what you're saying there, I come across this with many of the leaders I work with and coach, is that not a lot of leaders get to that stage of recognizing that's where they need to be in that row. You know, I'm part of the team. Yes, I'm leading and you're looking for me to direction, but I need to be part of that collaborative. So what challenges did you face? Bear in mind where you were coming from, being very resourceful, and I'm guessing a lot of the time not necessarily asking for help either. Because I can relate to that, yes. Where I came from, similar to you, is what challenge you faced as you went through that transition. Just to share that with us.
I think you find out that you're, and I see this with a lot of teams that I've dealt with in the last 7 years of my career. I've been a troubleshooter, so I go into a charitable trust that's failing for whatever reason, or they may have a certain project that they want me to help with. And I recognize when people are so far beyond the point of asking for help that they don't know how to. And being asked the question, you know, what do you need? How can I help you? How can I support you? They don't know how to answer it because they are, you know, that phrase, circling the drain. If you're sort of beyond the rim of the drain, it's dark, you can't hear what's going on, you are, all you've got to face you is your own stress and anxiety. And you really have to make a conscious effort and pull yourself up and look ahead and think, right, what does help need to look like for me? And that is, and you've also got to allow yourself to think, Jan, it's a living, okay? It's a very important part of your life, but it's not all of your life. It's keeping a roof over three adults' heads, but, you know, it get a bit of perspective. And you really have to sort of, you know, take yourself to one side and have a word with yourself and be your best friend. And it's so difficult to do that. And I've been in jobs where, you know, as a manager, you know, I haven't had a day off for a year. I've worked, you know, ridiculous hours, split shifts, you know, all the rest of it. And you do lose, you lose it. You lose a sense of perspective. And you just have to, you know, what it kind of, the transition for me was when I thought, do you know what? I want to be the sort of boss that staff that I've inherited who are in that situation can come to me and say, I don't know, I've lost the ability to ask for help. I know I need help because I'm failing on all of these fronts. But I help me, you know, I can't even, I've gone past the point at which I can describe what that help needs to look like, but I need to ask for help. And you have to really sort of unpick it and say, right, pause, you know, we're not splitting the atom here. We're opening a historic house to the public. It may be failing financially, but, you know, the world will still keep turning. Let's just hang on a minute and say, right, where are you struggling? If it helps, from my perspective, I think you need help there. You need to stop doing that. You need to do more of that because that helps. You need some more people on this. We need to pause that until next year because it's a massive project and there's no point starting it if we're going to fall over. And that's the sort of boss that I wanted to be. And yeah, and it, you really have to sort of stop yourself when you're on that downward trajectory and stress and strain is just overtaking you.
And sometimes in doing that, and you've talked about it more, sometimes we do need to ask for help. You know, sometimes it's a lonely place being a leader in that sense. So
the boss,
where were you most, exactly. So where were you most effective at asking for help? Where did you seek that at times where it was the most difficult for you?
Yeah, one of the most significant things that happened to me most recently was the loss of my son. He died 18 months ago and he was only 16. And it was sudden and unexpected. And it is, a bomb has gone off in my life. And like a building, because I think in buildings, when you see, you know, the walls have gone and the curtains are fluttering out in the fresh air because the wall's gone and the floor's gone and the ceiling's caving in and the rain's pouring it. That is how it feels. You are blown apart. And that happened to me when I was 4 months into a new contract as chief exec. And I knew that I needed to step away from work for a period, of course, and I was off for 6 weeks. And what I needed was, I needed to articulate what help returning to work looked like for me. And I think if that had happened earlier in my career, I wouldn't have been as good at asking for help because I put myself into the board's shoes. And I thought, right, they will not have a clue how to handle this. They will be, you know, they won't have a clue. I don't think any of them have been through this personally. And even if they had, it is the most individual, bespoke process and feeling. And it changes every day and it doesn't get better. It is. And anybody watching this who has experienced it will know exactly what I'm talking about. And you have to you know, it would be a luxury if all you had to worry about was missing your son and coming to terms with his loss and supporting his sister and his father through that. But you've got to keep working because you're the breadwinner and it, no one, you know, the mortgage company don't care whether you've lost your son. You've got to keep earning. And I thought, right, I will tell them exactly what I need when I come back. So I was quite specific. And I said, look, I know you're going to have to do a return to work form. Send me the form. I'll fill it in. I'll tell you what you need to know. I will come back to work. I would really welcome the ability to work from home for part of that time. And at times it might be I suddenly need to work from home. I am not comfortable with becoming very upset in public. So if that happens, I need to be able to retreat to a place that's not on display, that's not facing the public, which my job very much was. And if you can imagine, you're a chief exec, it's a new place, and you're, as so many often times people say, oh, we're at a pivotal moment. This organization is at a pivotal moment, and we need to build the narrative and, you know, raise the profile. And so there's lots of going before different people and trying to raise money and awareness and all the rest of it. So it's a very public-facing, high-profile role, and you're 4 months in. And, you know, so they don't know you, and they certainly didn't know my son or my family. And so I said, look, if I mention him, I don't want you to look at the top of your shoes, if you can do that, you know. I am going to mention him because I'll hear music or I'll see something, and that will be very relevant to something that was important to him. And I think people are very generally, in my experience, are not brilliant at dealing with grief. Certainly the trustees that I have come across aren't. And so I said, this is how it needs to look for me. And that was not picked up, and not that, you know, here's a bespoke, solution to a problem I know you're going to have. And they didn't take that on board. And yeah, some people were brilliant, absolutely brilliant, others less so. And as a leader, it taught me, never make assumptions about people without knowing the full story, because you may be looking at a beautiful facade of a building, but actually if you go around the back, it's all blown out and the wind, you know, the curtains are blowing in the window and the ceiling's fallen in. And so never assume that that you know what's going on, and don't be afraid to ask. People are very sort of worried about how they're going to engage with you, because it's not something that we do very much in society at all. So if I can learn anything from what I've been through and what I continue to go through, it is how to handle such a catastrophic impact on a member of staff. If they're going through similar, or they have been through similar, I would want to say, if you need help, tell me what it needs to look like, and I'll do my utmost to make it happen. And even if that includes, you might want to leave us, you might want to, you know, retract from your career. Well, we can talk about how that can happen as well without breaking any, you know, employment law at all. But it's just having honest conversations, and it really does teach you about humanity. And all that we do as leaders, we're dealing with human beings, whether we're selling to them, employing them, whether they volunteer for us, whether they're learning something, you're dealing with humanity. And I think despite everything, that is, I still love that. I still love engaging with people.
And I can tell that. And thank you very much for, you know, being so vulnerable in terms of telling your story around that. And obviously, I'm very sorry for your loss. And it's amazing how you found the courage and strength to put yourself in the shoes of those trustees and be very clear about what it was that you wanted to happen with that. There are many people, as you say, that wouldn't have that strength. And therefore, what I'm hearing from you, it's so important, is as a leader, when you come across this situation, your business, that kindness, compassion to actually reach out and offer that opportunity for them to give you how they want things to be in the next few months and years is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a kind of, it's a very tragic example, but it's also about not making assumptions about anybody that you engage with, including your customers. You know, don't assume that there is a certain background, a certain level of interest, a certain socioeconomic profile to your markets without actually checking that out, you know, because it changes. You know, crumbly old buildings is quite a niche thing. And it's, you know, it used to be a certain age, a certain demographic. But one thing I've learned is that actually, if you've got a building that's nearly 1,000 years old, it's got stories attached and woven into the fabric of it that will appeal to all people. And that really is important. And it's having that, just stopping yourself from making assumptions. I think there's a certain aura around the job title chief exec. You know, there's a sort of head wobbling moment when people say, oh, she's chief exec, you know, and you think, well, I still clean the loos, I still muck out donkeys, believe it or not. That's another story. But you know, I'm a sleeves rolled up chief exec, and people from the charitable sector will understand that you are not on a massive salary, that you have all the responsibility and accountability of those that are, but you're usually on, you know, quite a low salary for a high level of responsibility, and you will find yourself doing the jobs of people that don't exist in your team because you can't afford them.
Absolutely. Now, building on what you've told me in terms of particularly dealing with that situation over the last 18 months or so and how you try to deal with that from your own perspective, Shehrzad Shamim also talks in his book Positive Intelligence about our saboteurs that are there from our past that are there to protect us, but also kick in when we're feeling negative, judgmental, frustrated, angry, resentment, whatever it might be. Yeah. And that sometimes takes us away from the way that we try and sustain our leadership style. So how do you make sure that you manage your negativity or the saboteurs, as he calls them, on an ongoing basis?
One of the most reached for tools in my toolbox is humour. And it sustains me every time. And a sense of perspective, you know, you've got to, before you get carried away with yourself or the situation or the project or the building, you've got to sort of say, sorry, why are we doing this again? You know, oh, right, we open the place so that, well, one, it brings in income to sustain it, and it's an important place in and of itself. It's a hub for cultural history. And people enjoy coming here. If you visit a place that is beautiful, either because it's, you know, the most incredible piece of architecture. So I would challenge anybody to walk underneath the roof in Westminster Hall that dates back to, I think it's about 1393. Look up and do not, you know, fail to be moved by what you're looking at, because what was built there at that time was built by people who were not educated. And I remember learning when I went to university again to do a master's degree in historic environment conservation, and I learned that the imperial measurement system comes from labourers knowing that that bit of your thumb is an inch and that bit of your arm is a foot, because they were not taught, you know, they were not educated. They were incredible craftsmen, and some of the oldest buildings around still stand today because they were built brilliantly. So when you walk into a space like that, you don't have to have done a degree to experience how beautiful that is. Just the fact that it's still standing and in good nick all this time later. Or you walk into a beautiful space, be it a garden or a landscape, or there is something wonderful that happens to you physically. You feel better for being in that space and for seeing those beautiful things. And I think that's what you get. You got to go back to basics. It's not about, you know, sort of the politics. It's not about, you know, sort of vanity projects. It's about enabling access to a space that truly, really does belong to the whole nation, and they should be able to enter it in a way that is affordable and engaging, and for those that have the most to benefit from it. If I can tell you a story about early on in my career, I worked for the National Trust, and not far from where I'm sitting today, which is, it was East Midlands region back in the day. And there's an amazing property called Cork Abbey, and it is the country house in decline was its strapline nearly 30 years ago. And I was helping the person that worked there deal with a school group. So a load of school children had come out on a visit on a coach from Burton-on-Trent, and they were going to see this magnificent house, which when you say in decline, I mean, the wallpaper's peeling off the walls. When the family that owned it, if they had a rug that wore out, they bought a new one and threw it on top of the old one. So in some rooms you had 10 rugs. And it was just amazing. It just brilliant. And so it wasn't posh, you know, it was of that time and of that family struggling with its upkeep. And they had to sort of enact an act of parliament in order for them to hand the house over and do, you know, avoid death duties, but say it's over to the nation, it belongs to you. Anyway, this young lad gets off the bus and he's looking up and he's transfixed. This is out in the car park in the open air, not yet inside the building. And I said to him, you know, you're all right? What's the matter? And he looked up and he said, I never knew there was so much sky. And I thought, oh my goodness, you probably only have ever seen like a little grey rectangle of sky where you live. You have an absolute right to see all of the sky whenever you need to, and it shouldn't cost you a penny. And that story stuck with me. And everywhere I've gone, I've tried to enable a greater level of access for those people that most need it, that can't afford it, that don't know that this is, you know, a capability brown landscape or, you know, a house built by a stellar architect. They just want to engage with somewhere that is beautiful and peaceful. And that's so important. That's what sort of drives what I do, really.
Thank you. And you've got so much experience to draw upon. It's been lovely. The audience has been able to listen and watch today. So if you think about distilling into your experience and what you've learned from other leaders and your own leadership and the experiences you've had, what advice would you offer to the audience, particularly those leaders out there who can relate to this story of yours today about channeling those early experiences? What advice would you give them to turning that into sustainable leadership for them?
I would say, remember that you are stronger than you think, and that your story is going to sustain you as a leader. Think about the leader that you would most enjoy being led by, and become that leader. Never sort of accept the status quo. Always remain curious and open to learning. And you can do it. You can absolutely do it. It doesn't matter what your background, you know, what your education, you can do it. And there is, you know, there are so many ways into becoming a leader that, you know, choose a path that that's right for you, and don't forget to enjoy it. You know, it's a means to an end, but it's also enjoy meeting those characters and remembering why you're in whatever sector it is that you're in. For me, it's a charitable trust. For others, it may be more commercial, but there is you can do good things for a lot of people in a lot of different ways, and if you focus on that, you will inevitably be a strong, listening, capable, engaging leader. Don't think you can't do it, because that's what people thought about me, but here I am.
Exactly. And what I love tying in the story you said about the boys while looking up to the sky is, and a lot of people that we know and have come across, and a lot of people I work with, is there are many people who are from disadvantaged backgrounds who haven't had the role models maybe to inspire them to become the best kind of leader, not only leading themselves, but communities and businesses. So I agree totally. It starts with self-leadership and belief, and I'm hoping some people out there in the audience will be able to relate to that and hear you. So a final question for you before we move into the final stages of the podcast and show. Obviously, you've got a future now where you want to put your efforts and your passion is going to be. So what will you be in service of in the future, Jan, and how can people collaborate with you, help you if they want to get involved?
Thank you. Yes. My focus is going to be on returning home. And home for me is the Isle of Skye and Scotland, because that's where my heart is and where my boy is buried. And although he's with me every day, I don't need to see where he is. What I wanted to do when this happened, he had great plans to study music, modern music. He was brilliant at maths and geography, and, you know, a sane parent would have said, you know, follow those good results and do that. But his passion was music. It was playing the electric guitar. And so he was planning to go to music college to study modern music. And I thought, I would love to be able to set up a foundation in his memory, in his name, to raise money to enable people from a similar background. So, you know, sort of rural background, and enable someone else to go to college because Will can't. And that's my focus at the moment. So I've got a name. I've got the foundations there. It's called the Will Foundation, and the logo is a little sketch that he drew when he was 11. And so that's what I'm going to focus on is setting that up. And if anybody wants to support me, that would be amazing. So thank you for
what's the best way to get in contact with
to
you?
Talk about that.
Yeah, what's the best way for people to get in contact with you?
The email is jan@thewillfoundation.com. So, contact me and we can have a chat and see what we can do to help others.
Excellent. Well, Jan, I really appreciate you sharing your experiences with our audience today and just, you know, being so vulnerable with the story. I know many people would really relate to your story. And I know that many of them have been inspired as well to reflect on their own leadership style, how they might take a different approach to leading themselves in the future and how they might lead others in the future due to what you've shared today. So thank you very much for being on the show, sharing what you've shared. I hope that everybody out in the audience has enjoyed this episode of Confessions of a Successful Leader. You can find out more information about conscious leadership and self-coaching just by typing Andrew Talents into LinkedIn or Google. There'll be lots of material you'll find associated with my name. And until next time, don't forget to stay present, curious, and above all, conscious. Goodbye, everyone. Thanks, Jan. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Confessions of a Successful Leader. You can access all previous episodes of the show at confessionsofasuccessfulleader.com. If you are interested in finding out more about conscious leadership and self-coaching, just type in Andrew Talents into LinkedIn or your favorite browser, and you'll find my contact details and all the content that you need. Until next time, don't forget to stay present, curious, and above all, conscious.
Thank you for enjoying this content by Billionaires in Boxes. If you would like to be a guest or a host, be sure to get in contact with us at billionairesinboxes.com.